What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. A while back, a friend of the pod asked me what subscriptions I'd recommend for news and analysis on world politics. And it was actually a hard question to answer on the spot, believe it or not. But I've got a great answer now. Mother effin' World Politics Review. If you're a fan of Undiplomatic, you should be reading World Politics Review. It's obviously worldly. It's in the title. It's not obsessed with Trump, and it has a great mix of analysis and journalism. Also, why do you think I'm doing this pitch? World Politics Review is an official sponsor of the show, and the best way to back us right now is to back them. So give them a chance. They're offering a 25% discount subscription for Undiplomatic listeners, and if you want to subscribe to their daily newsletter, which you should, you can do it for free. Just visit wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That's wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That'll get you the free newsletter, and it'll also provide you the code for the 25% discount should you want to subscribe. So get on the train, wpr.pub/undiplomatic. Peace. What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, a show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. Another distributed episode with Jake Dello, Kiara Mitchell, Gabby Magnuson. And this is, like, I guess, the new business for the COVID, post-COVID era. We're never going to see each other again. I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be like this for a while, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think distributed is the new normal for a while.
Yeah. Whoops. I accidentally hit mute on Jake. Because we're
Thanks, man.
I'm getting new to Zoom.
I know it's already unofficial, but yeah. I mean, come on. It's a bit harsh, right?
Okay. So just a few quick hits before we get into the show. One is a shout out to a dude named Christopher Woody, who is an editor at Business Insider, because he gave a shout out to the podcast. He did this article talking about the brutality of sanctions intersecting with the pandemic. And so it's like places where the US is imposing maximum pressure. You know, we talked about this with Iran, with North Korea too. This is an issue. And he quoted a discussion that we had in the pod maybe a couple weeks ago. And
yeah, it was a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. And so he used that Iran discussion we had about sanctions in his piece. So shout out to the shout out. And then two news hits. There's actually like a lot of shit going on, but you know, this is not your only source of news, I hope. One is that the Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong, he gave an interview with Fareed Zakaria on CNN, and Singaporean prime ministers, heads of state, are like famously pontificators. Like they like think of themselves as grand strategists. They're among the most intellectual political leaders of the region. Singapore always punches above its weight as a state. And so he had an interview with Fareed Zakaria, and he chastised the US and China for the obvious shit, for blame shifting each other, for the throwing conspiracy theories at each other. And
he told them off.
I mean, so like Singapore is in this famous position of just hedging between the great powers and trying to be the mouse whispering in the ear of both of them, you know. And so it's because of that, there's like always a lot of tact or like diplomatic obscuring truth and honesty. But this was like more more candid than normal, and everything he said was right. And he was throwing shade at the U.S. In particular, even though it was a little bit like a pox on both your houses, but it was like disproportionately on the U.S. And he the thing that like I sort of disagreed with was, he was like, you know, the U.S. has shown that it has the capacity for leadership globally, that it could be leading this. It has the material goods to lead this. It has the knowledge to lead this. It has the goodwill to lead this. And it's not showing any leadership. And if it doesn't show leadership, you know, states like us are going to be looking elsewhere for leadership. I agree that that's probably what they would like to be thinking. And that's what states should be thinking about in like the COVID or the post-Trump era. But for small states, there is no plan B. For a state like Singapore, or even like, if you count on the US in some way, in the way you do your like foreign policy strategy, you're in trouble, man. Like, what is the plan B? There isn't one. China is showing that it's not exactly ready for leadership or to substitute for the US. So, you know, I think it's wishful thinking to say that you'll look elsewhere for leadership. I think the more realistic thing is to expect a greater sense of anarchy in the world because of a vacuum.
It's pretty big coming from a head of state, though.
Yeah.
To come out and say it in this climate, especially with everything going on this week and in the past month, really, from a head of state, that's pretty huge.
Yes. So, I don't know. It was a good interview. I'll try to link to it in the show notes. It's just like a canary in the coal mine for where, you know, leaders of Asian states may be looking or going. They're definitely looking for an alternative to the U.S. It's just there isn't one forthcoming. The other big news is it's an indicator, or it's part of a larger trend. This did not show up on a lot of people's radars, but it's more important than how it sounds, which is that the EU successfully set up, or specifically it was France, Britain, and Germany, set up an alternative to the SWIFT system, which the US controls, so that it could trade with Iran. And so famously, the EU and the US disagree about Iranian sanctions, and the EU is softening its stance more and more as the US is hardening its stance more and more toward Iran. And the big problem was, like, the US dollar centrality and the control of things like the SWIFT system. So SWIFT is, for people who don't know, it's the software basically and the code that is used to exchange information between financial institutions. So it's like the information backbone for the global economy, for global transactions. And so the control of SWIFT is what makes it possible for the US to impose kind of like punitive sanctions in a way that most countries can't on their own. And so the US abuse of sanctions as a tool and like US excessive use of its financial power led to states trying to circumvent, you know, US economic centrality. And it's one thing when China is, or Russia is trying to circumvent, you know, US economic power. It's another thing when like liberal democratic states are trying to do it. And so the EU has...
The allies, right?
That's right.
The allies.
And they've set up an actual mechanism that they've actually used now in a transaction with Iran to do business with Iran. And this is running up against or conflicting with U.S. sanctions. So this is trouble in the sense of like U.S.-EU conflict, but then also just in a larger like zoom out sense, you know, the U.S. is losing its financial power or over time.
Well, what a time to do it, because the EU is pretty much falling apart and now they want to start beef with the United States. Timing much?
Yeah, so in one sense it's like it's bad timing or like suboptimal timing for the EU. If they create an alternative to the SWIFT system, if they create a basis for financial institutions to do transactions that circumvent the US, if other states join in on that or other banks do, then the EU will take America's financial power or economic power. So like,
so this sort of a way of like getting what they might have lost back? Or,
well, I don't know if that's their intention, but yeah, maybe. It's hard. There's a lot of like ways that this can spin into the future. It's not totally clear, but and it's not clear what the EU's intentions are other than being able to, you know, circumvent sanctions in a sense in this immediate Iran case. But the potential is huge. The U.S. could end up on the sidelines a decade from now.
Yeah. Do you think that the United States will let that happen, Van? Do you think they would let that happen without a fight?
I don't know. Who knows? It's not, I mean, what leverage does the U.S. have? Pulling out of NATO, maybe, but it's separate. Like, NATO is separate from the EU, you know?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately for the United States, that's true. Their bargaining power sort of ends with NATO, I guess. And the SWIFT system.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. It's just something to watch. And amid the, like, fear of pandemic and World War III and everything, people were losing track of this. So, I thought I would shout it out on the show.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them.
All right, for Prediction Market this week, Gabby helped me out with the first question. Will we see a coronavirus, in air quotes, troublemaker-related death in the Philippines by the half-year mark?
Good question. So I just saw that the Philippines President Duterte issued like a shoot-to-kill order against anybody who was violating the lockdown, the quarantine. Which is like, that's obviously like super authoritarian and illegal and immoral, but maybe it's effective. We'll see. I wouldn't recommend it.
I mean, if we can say anything about authoritarian regimes, effectiveness is probably in the camp.
I mean, I will actually say, was there a timeline attached to that question?
Before the, by half, the half year. Halfway through the year, yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure. People will get popped. The question I have is like, will people get popped in the name of quarantine enforcement, but really it's about corruption or pay to play or taking out your enemies, the dual motive, and the pandemic is the pretext or something?
Well, if it goes anywhere like his last shoot to kill order, I think corruption is going to be very high on that list.
Kill your neighborhood drug dealer, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think what's already being seen, the reason why I wanted to bring up this question as well, is because they're already using like military force against protesters. Mm-hmm. It's just, people in the Philippines trying to be like, hey, is it cool if maybe you protected us from having to interact with the coronavirus? Because for all sorts of reasons, whether they work near hospitals or obviously like, especially Manila's like an overpopulation problem. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, just protesting on the streets and stuff, and they just rolled out all these military people, and it's like,
the developing countries and countries that are on the like the bubble of authoritarianism, you know, where like they're not consolidated democracies but they have like elements of democracy, those are the countries that are like the pandemic is fucking them, or like they're at greatest risk because they don't have the capacity to respond properly. They don't have traditions of governance that's free of corruption and like rationally efficient. And so like the Philippines falls in this category of countries that is in big fucking trouble. And the pandemic could end up accelerating some, you know, negative political trends around the world, including in the Philippines, I think.
Well, that's a bit tragic. Question two. This is also a bit tragic. Will Italy receive any direct aid from fellow EU member states, namely Germany, before the end of the month?
Before the end of the month? I mean, ideally, yes. Realistically, not before the end of the month. Surely at some point. Yeah, I'm going to say no.
Why is that?
I read an article that said if Italy's one of their ministers essentially said if we don't get aid, the EU is going to collapse.
Yeah. Well, Italy and Serbia and a few other countries, I think Spain now too, they're relying heavily on China, and they're not relying at all on EU member states. So it's a little bit self-help at this point. It may not stay that way, but yeah.
What is it with these last couple of years of just helping everyone but your allies?
Well, that's the Trump. That's the Trump era.
That's the Trump effect, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Question three, will we see any direct retaliation from China following the signing of the Taiwan Allies International Protection and Enhancement Initiative Act that was signed in recently before August?
So this act, I can't remember what exactly it does, but it's definitely contra Chinese interests or Chinese preferences with regard to Taiwan.
It essentially... expand in the United States sphere, it essentially forces those countries to adopt a recognized Taiwan, essentially, which is directly against the one China policy.
That's right. And it was, there were like punitive measures or diplomatic sanctions of some kind, pressure on third parties to recognize Taiwan. And if they didn't, then, you know, there would be some sort of at least symbolic punishment. Yeah. So this is China, obviously, would not be happy about this. I don't know if they've said publicly about it, but my prediction is that there won't be direct retaliation for this because it's like pouring water on a wet sponge. There wouldn't be any point to it. Like, it's already wet. The rivalry is already on, you know? And so there's already a lot of tit for tat rhetorically, substantively, economically. And so I don't think this specific bill is going to trigger China.
Do you see it as sort of a launching point for maybe some drastic anti-United States, maybe not as a direct response to the specific act, but this increasing trend from the United States to sign anti-China policy into law, is that going to be a real stepping stone to conflict, do you think?
Well, it's a stepping stone toward greater confrontation. For sure, the situation is pretty fucked. The war is like always a low likelihood, but you want, as a policy practitioner, you want to like keep it as low of a likelihood as possible, right? 1% odds is better than 5% odds, even though both are low. So like in this case, in aggregate, the odds of a conflict between the US and China are pretty low, but they're higher than they've been. They're much higher. And it seems like the odds keep getting better and better as we move through not just the Trump era, but this pandemic crisis itself. Things are tightening. So maneuvering space for policymakers and diplomats to avoid war, that maneuvering space is narrowing. And that's the concern. And so this bill and whatever China might do in response or not, or just in response to other stuff, it's reducing the trade space for making not warlike actions.
Well, what a happy prediction market this week.
Yeah. All right.
Time for Say of Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
So for this first tweet thread I found is from Eric Van Rijthoven, and he talks about how we should use the war metaphor to frame our response to COVID-19. His take is essentially, do not do it, even if it functions as a powerful mechanism for collective mobilization and emergency action. Rijthoven lists all the ways that this could be used badly. The war metaphor would demand the creation of an enemy. His concluding thoughts are also why I wanted to bring it up in the podcast. He goes, I would love to believe that when the dust settles, the country will be propelled into an intense period of reflectivity and transformation, and that Americans would finally get the public health care and government competence they so sorely deserve. But I think another scenario is just as likely, blaming groups for snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. The narrative will be, America could have won the war on Corona, if not for the Democrats, migrants, Jews, globalists, insert racist trope, etc. That will be terrible, which is a bit of an understatement. Yeah, that would be terrible.
Yeah, the I've seen a few people say versions of this, and like this particular thread was very on point, warning against, it's not just like the war metaphor is a problem, but it's part of a larger securitization of the pandemic response. When you christen something, I feel like we've talked about this before. For sure, we talk about this in Intro to Security Studies, but like
we've definitely talked about securitization.
Yeah. There's a whole week on it in my course.
A week took me three.
Well, some are faster than others. So obviously, like once you christen something a national security issue, you do that because of its power, right? Once something counts as national security, you can shut down debates, you can circumvent the processes of normal politics, you can mobilize resources, you can mobilize opinion, you get a faster, more effective response. And the bizarro shit that's happening right now is like, you're getting all of the war metaphor rhetoric and securitization of the pandemic response. Almost everything the US is doing has a military face on it right now. And yet, the mobilization is not nearly adequate to the problem. And in part, it's because like the problem requires like public health, public policy tools, not fucking M16 rifles.
Yeah.
And so this is there's a disproportionality in means and ends here. Like it just doesn't add up. I think what's happening, I've seen a couple people on Twitter talk about this, is like, yeah, you're getting body counts as if this is a war. You're getting body counts worse than a lot of wars, actually, in the US. Yeah. And we're getting all the hysteria of like something being a national security emergency. But the reason you're not getting the mobilization, or you're not getting the translation, the benefits of securitizing this, because all of that energy of, you know, you get super empowered, it's converting into like graft and corruption, and it's getting distorted into things like border walls and corporate payoffs. And so the people in charge, Trump and his fucking lackeys, are, it's like they're operating on a pathology that prevents the benefits of securitization, but is still locking in all those risks that you get when you securitize something. And it's a little bit the worst of both worlds.
Just seems like they're asking the general to fix a scientific issue, which he's not trained in.
They're literally, you know, doing that, yeah.
Yeah, that's so terrifying, because it's a movie trope. It's a pop culture trope. Anytime a general appears in a film, his answer's nuke it.
Yep.
Nuke it. It's like, just nuke it. Just nuke it. Why not?
Yeah. So anyways, it was a great thread. And I've got a couple others. One quick one from Nick Bisley, who is a professor at La Trobe University in Australia. He just had this very short comment. He said, good to see Asia's multilateral institutions responding so effectively to a new security crisis. Wait, obviously. Yeah.
The way you read that.
It's the, yeah. I didn't know how to like put the right inflection in my voice on it. He's being like tongue in cheek, obviously, right? Because Asia's institutions, they lack the rule enforcement capacity that, you know, your global institutions have, or that European institutions have. And that's by design historically, but it also makes them fairly feckless. And so I just wanted to highlight this, because there is this ongoing problem of Asian states counting a little too much on institutions, even though institutions are super important. And so like they don't allow institutions to have the functional capacity to deal with serious problems. They use it as like performance and theater, and to play nice with each other, to like share norms together, but while failing to address serious problems. And China's presence distorts some of this even further, because China co-opts countries like Laos and Cambodia and prevents them from allowing ASEAN to do things. Like there's like a host of problems here, and Nick Bisley very tersely got to the point with his tweet. Second tweet is from actually friend of the pod, sort of, Antonio Delera, who worked on the Julian Castro campaign with me and migrated to Warren at the same time I did. And he had, I think, a much more important role in both campaigns than I did. I was basically a groupie for both. And so we did the same migration, right? Castro to Warren. And he said, quote, lots of folks watching the movie Contagion these days. It's a good movie, very relevant. I think more folks should look at what's happening to the economy right now, though, and start watching Grapes of Wrath, which obviously, classic John Steinbeck book, super depressing, about the American Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. Pretty awful when you read it. Like, I've become obsessed with like reading about Great Depression history the past couple of years. I wonder why. And it's awful. It was globally awful. Like reading about, even about like Australia and New Zealand, like how people lived in the Great Depression, it mirrors how people in California lived in the Great Depression, which was just, you know, having to skip meals, kids going to schools in rice flour sacks, not having clothes, like
all essentially not living, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not the, living, it not, is yeah. the dark ages, man. And I have a hard time finding economists now who think that we're going to avoid a Great Depression. The money, the smart money is on a Great Depression. So, you know, we've got technology now, so like we can entertain ourselves to death while we have no money. But this is trouble, man.
The age of spectacle.
Yeah.
The age of spectacle.
We need to eat something if it's not food. So shout out to Antonio, because he's focusing on something that, or he wants us to focus on something that is, you know, even in the best case scenario in terms of resolving the pandemic, and if the optimal outcome happens where we get a vaccine and it's globally distributed and we get this thing under wraps, we still have a global economy that is in the shitter, and unemployment just keeps going up.
Well, even I know this is an international podcast, and I try and keep New Zealand out of it because we're not exactly the most internationally relevant country. But just it's sort of foreshadowing what might happen to international economies. Yesterday, I think one of our biggest media conglomerates essentially shut down and made most of their staff redundant, and that's huge. Yeah. Like that media company has essentially been a New Zealand staple for years since I've been born. And they've just made everyone redundant. And if that's going to foreshadow how the rest of the world's going to go, I'm absolutely shit scared.
Yeah. Yeah. And that media conglomerate, I can't remember what they were called, but I read like they
Bauer Media.
Yeah. They shut down right away. It's basically the company that produces all of the like grocery store magazines that you see. Like the equivalent, New Zealand equivalent of like Us Weekly and all that shit.
I mean, it's not a huge cultural loss, but economic-wise, I guess it is.
Well, and that's happening all over the U.S. right now too. Like my little brother lost his job fucking right away because he's a sushi chef, and who needs sushi when you're in lockdown? I would actually argue I do need sushi in lockdown.
Yeah, I would love it.
Yeah, I say that.
Oh, I miss sushi so much.
I miss takeout. Like in the States.
I miss McDonald's. I had a dream about McDonald's and I don't know why.
Because you can't have it. Yeah. So
I just want something that isn't eggs.
Yeah.
So I can cook.
Yeah. I mean,
first world problems, right?
It could be worse, right? Like the Antonio tweet hints that it probably actually will be worse. At the same time, be grateful and worried.
God, gee, I'm going to walk away from this episode a really optimistic, happy day.
Yeah.
You know, I'm loving it.
If we just keep laughing, it'll all feel fine.
Okay.
And then the last tweet is from my man, friend of the pod, Dan Nexon, Georgetown professor, godfather of progressive foreign policy. He had a tweet. This is a very IR nerd tweet, so sorry for those listening who are not IR nerds. Also, if you're not an IR nerd, why are you listening?
I was going to say.
Dan just said, hostilities ceased in the paradigm wars over a decade ago, and yet we still lack a formal peace treaty. And what he's talking about there, the paradigm wars, are the fucking rap battle between realists, liberals, and constructivists in the it's mostly like the 80s and the 90s, where they were analyzing foreign policy and world events to make arguments about whose paradigm was superior. And so those arguments back and forth, and that's the context in which like people like John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt and Bob Cohen and Alex Wendt and all these guys, Joe Nye, that's the context in which they all like became super famous. And so they were, you know, the trigger men in the paradigm wars. I was thinking about this in broad IR theory, people like Nexon, people who are not like foreign policy specialists in a specific area. They're just big thinker specialists, right? Among the big thinkers, the paradigm wars did end around the turn of the century, like 2000 or so. You don't see articles getting published or books getting published after 2000 that are making arguments about like the primacy of realism or the primacy of constructivism. It's all just like, oh, maybe these are just ways of thinking about the world. And like, if we make different assumptions, it leads to different implications for policy or whatever. That's true in like that big sense. And like, I like to think of these paradigms that way too, a little flexible and basically analytically humble. But I know like,
well, I think you might have said, Van, they're more like lenses to look through as opposed to ideologies to hold.
That's right. And a lens is going to be more or less useful depending on, you know, circumstances. So in that context, though, like I do Asian security mostly, so I am like a area specialist first and then like theorist second in a way. And in Asian security studies, basically the proxy paradigm wars have been fighting and not stopping. So the regional security studies and the regional specialists have taken up arms in the paradigm wars, fighting each other about this stuff. They're applying different, when you like open up a regional journal, like Asian Security, International Relations of the Asia Pacific, it's full of articles that are published now, 2020, that are arguing about like the superiority of, you know, balance of power theory or whatever to explain this specific case of, I don't know, Japanese security policy. And okay. that's what like Asian security studies is now. Like, big IR theories applied to small specific cases and then filling in the gaps where there are gaps. And it looks very much like people trying to vindicate one theory over another, kind of. And so I think the paradigm wars have not ended. They've only ended for people like Nexon. They continue fighting in the periphery of the regional security studies journals. So I just wanted to flag that as both a good insight, but also an amendment for people who are just pure IR nerds.
Just a question, man. Do you think the paradigm wars ended in the, I guess, the grand theory sort of arena, and it's sort of happening in the Asian security area now? Is it because originally it was sort of a bit Eurocentric? There wasn't really much theory discussed about what's happened in Asia? Do you think they're finally sort of not catching up? That's the wrong way to say it, but like
there's studies that are focusing on it now. Yeah,
they're trying to apply these theories as paradigms to Asian issues as opposed to the First World War, the Cold War, and stuff.
Well, so that's the other. I guess there, what I described was like one trend in Asian security studies. The other one, sorry for people who don't care about this. The other
too
trend,
bad.
Yeah, it's my podcast. God damn it. The other trend that Asian security studies, though, which we talked about like a long time ago on the show, was, I don't know what you call it, like Eastern IR theory or whatever, but it was, it's kind of like there's an attitude of like rejecting IR theories that came, whose origins are European cases, which is like a lot of basic IR. And
all of it, really, isn't it?
Not totally, but.
When I say all of it, I mean the First World War and such. You can't really ignore it if you study IR theory, right?
Yeah. And so the thing that's been in vogue, if you're an Asia scholar, is to preface your research or whatever with, oh, we should not take these canonical IR theories as a given because they come from the Western experience, and we have this place called the East that, you know, has its own historical experience, and nobody's looking at that, so we should look at that. It's simultaneously correct and way overplayed, way overstated. General theories are always going to have some use for explaining your little rice bowl, your little area. But they're never
nice pun, man.
Well, yeah, there we go. But they're never going to be able to explain everything, and they're not supposed to, because they are general IR theories, right? They're not supposed. They have scope conditions. There's limitations, and there are idiosyncrasies in every like country or region where things won't apply. And it's at the same time, it's totally valid to extract new knowledge, if you can, from other regions that are untapped, other cultures that are untapped, right? So it's valid to look at the East or Asian history or whatever as case material.
Yeah.
But you can't presume that theories derived from elsewhere don't apply. And if they don't apply perfectly, that's not falsifying them. That doesn't rule them out. So
it seems like they're throwing baby out with the bathwater, right?
A little bit, yeah. That's one trend. That's the cool kids trend in Asia. But then the other one is straightforward, taking the paradigm wars and IR theory and then applying them to Asian case studies to vindicate your given perspective.
Yeah.
So if you're a critical scholar or a realist, there's a lot of realists. Actually, like everybody who does Asia is either, it seems like, a critical scholar or a realist, and like not really a lot in between anymore. So I just wanted to shout out to Dan because I don't know. It's a nerdy thing and I care about it, but nobody else does.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
So for Armchair Analysis this week, I found a piece that comes from Slate. Fred Kaplan, the writer, makes his argument clear in the title, Kick Hungary Out of the EU and NATO. On the 31st of March, Hungary's prime minister was handed the power to rule by decree indefinitely because of the coronavirus outbreak, which, shit. Hungary had entered the Western alliance after the Cold War as a fledgling democracy, and this move reverted the country into an autocracy. So while the move was done to combat the coronavirus, Kaplan notes that we also saw a similar move, that is, using the law to justify the measures taken to keep him in power. In 2015, where Orban declared a state of emergency to stave off the flow of refugees entering Hungary. Yeah. So the EU's Justice Commissioner said that the union's members would assess whether the Hungarian laws violated their rule of law standards, which it evidently does.
Yeah.
These steps also included violating NATO's principles from Article 2 of the 1949 Washington Treaty to the Membership Action Plan. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so the...
Direct violation.
Yeah, yeah, fucking hungry, man. So there's so much to say about that. First of all, Fred Kaplan is a friend of the pod. He wrote this bitchin' book called Wizards of Armageddon about NATO's or nuclear strategy in like the 80s.
That's so metal.
It's so, it's like a classic. I think he won a bunch of awards for it. If you're interested in the history of nuclear strategy, he has written the ultimate book on that. But he's also just a good writer. And anyways, this piece, I said on Twitter, like this exact same thing. I just don't have the Slate platform. Hello. And he, the problem with this is that NATO doesn't have an exclusion mechanism. Right. Like if you find that Hungary or any other country is in violation of the NATO charter, what you gonna do, man? I mean, what, like, you can't, as currently configured, there is no way vehicle to boot people.
Yeah.
But you have to, because like my take, my more succinct take than his, was like an attack on one is not or should not be an attack on all if you're not all of the same or like shared political identity. Like the reason why you stand in solidarity with each other is because of like a baseline of common shared humanity, which includes certain like, you know, rule of law and protection for minorities. And so like when you start extending that attack on one, attack on all to the protection of dictatorships, you are by proxy guilty of violating those human rights. Like you're aiding and abetting the dictator. And like, we're going to risk nuclear war, which is the upper end problem for NATO, in defense of a dictator. That's not right. It's anti-progressive. I know everybody's not a progressive. So fuck Hungary. It's not a smart bet. And the United States shouldn't be defending Hungary. So there has to be a way for NATO to address situations like this.
Well, the fact Hungary has been the black sheep of Europe for a long time, and the fact that they've openly broken thousands of human rights regulations, just international law. They hold yearly neo-Nazi marches to commemorate the day they got freed from the Soviets.
Yeah.
It's heinous. It's, well, when I say it's heinous, but I've never been to Hungary. It just seems so alien that they are in a defensive alliance with the United Kingdom and France and Germany, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's just a
strange bedfellows. Yeah.
There's the history of NATO expansion accounts for it, but like circumstances have changed so much since then.
I can't imagine that removing people from NATO, for example, the process would be quick. Because I mean, as soon as they do it to one person, that sets the precedent for like everyone else just in case, right? So I mean, even without the, I guess, whatever's happening in the world now, I can't imagine the process, you know, to just remove Hungary from NATO would, I don't know, like be over in a week.
Well, how do you do? Yeah, that's the problem. Like,
yeah, it's how do you do it?
If you had a way to do it, it could happen immediately. I mean, if you could get all the other NATO member countries to agree to immediately act to expel them. So it's like, it's a shared statement, a consensus statement or something. And it's like, okay, you can pretend like you're NATO, but you're not in NATO anymore. We're not going to protect you.
Okay.
Go fuck off, whatever. Like, if you could do that, then you'd be able to expel them quite quickly, even without a real mechanism. But how are you going to achieve that level of consensus? I'm sure there's a bunch of small Eastern European states who aren't so keen to just start booting people out of NATO. Like, they want the regional solidarity.
Albania's just joined.
Yeah. Right?
Albania's just joined last week, officially. I think it was last week they officially joined NATO. Mm. And I don't think they're going to be in the mood to be kicking people out, even though they should, because it says in their charter. When I say it's not even a moral issue, he's directly breaking the rules.
Yeah.
It's
there's
no gray area.
Yeah. Emma Ashford at the Cato Institute was, this is one of her, you know, longer term hobby horses, I think. And she was just like, this whole Hungary situation brings up the question of whether NATO is fundamentally a like concert of democracies or it's a strategic collective security agreement. And we've tried to have it both ways forever, but cases like Hungary, and this isn't going to be the last time a dictatorship pops up in Europe, they are forcing us to determine which one it is. And I just don't think it's sustainable to have a collective security arrangement with a bunch of dictatorships in these days. So I don't know.
Well, not ones that act like Hungary does.
Yeah. No.
I mean, I know that the world's like currently on fire and all that. Is this issue even like on people's radar? Is this like a thing that they're like, oh, we should tackle this now? Or are they more concerned with other things?
Not the public. Not the public. This whole show is basically about issues the public is not fucking aware of.
That's true.
So like, that's fair. People, the NATO policy people are all over this. NATO itself is hand-wringing about this. European countries are like, what the fuck do we do, man? Yeah. But, and you know, Trump and his fucking alt-right people are probably like, yes. But this is, you know, like the average person doesn't know where fucking Hungary is on a map.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. All right.
It's a tough position for old Hungary, because they can't afford to be kicked out of anything, but they also can't afford to be locking people in storage containers that you put on a ship.
You know, it does raise a question. Yeah, like, I'm firmly against extending collective security to a dictatorship, like, as a personal position. I think that's what makes the most strategic sense. I think it's what's morally right. But there is a question about whether, does that just mean that they, like, openly align with Russia? Or, like, they become a home for neo-fascism the way Afghanistan became a home for fucking Al-Qaeda? You like, what? I don't know. Like, there's questions here about the cause and effect of kicking them out of NATO. And to be totally honest, I haven't, like, fully wrestled with that. I don't imagine a future president who's not Trump. I don't imagine them risking nuclear war in the name of protecting an odious dictatorship, not even a normal one, but like an especially odious one.
Well, you raise an interesting point, man. What's the alternative?
Yeah.
You know, because do we, at least if they're in NATO, they're under some sort of control.
Yeah.
They're under, but with Russia, I don't know if that control is going to be extended by Russia, if they're even going to care about what human rights rules Hungary breaks.
Yeah. No, there is an interesting like engage versus isolate question at play here. I will concede that. All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
So the first question this week is from Sean Wolfgang, a friend of the pod. Once the COVID pandemic is over, do you think it will lead to more international cooperation or more isolationism between states? And which aspects of each are you most hopeful for and most worried about in the long run?
Oh, good questions. So I think it's actually, the answer is probably like a little bit of both. Like, in certain areas, we're probably going to see more international cooperation or more transnational cooperation, especially among scientific communities and scientific communities that are within democracies, and then some, like Singapore's technically a dictatorship, but they have something to offer here. And so, like, we may see more cooperation around this narrow issue of fighting pandemics. I think we are seeing, though, like a pulling apart of international institutions, the World Health Organization itself. I didn't mention this in like past episodes, but China has fucked that place up. They have basically muzzled the head of the World Health Organization, preventing him from doing anything to help Taiwan or to talk about Taiwan. And so literally an organization that should not be part of, you know, great power politics or strategic competition, they're being made a pawn. And it's at the cost of Taiwan civil society, Taiwan lives. And so the international architecture for order is fraying apart, I think. And the pandemic is kind of accelerating it. But like, this was, I mean, Trump was fueling a lot of this anyway. This was like already a trend. And the pandemic is just an accelerant to it, I think. So I think you will see areas of cooperation, but then areas of just like a breakdown of international order. And then the question becomes, what happens when order breaks down? That is why we have IR theory. It doesn't look good. it's international anarchy, and that means self-help.
I was gonna say, a guy called Hobbes wrote about that.
Yeah, it sucks, man. Nasty, brutish, short. That's life. And so that's what we have to look forward to, I think. I wrote a piece for the Loewe Institute a couple weeks ago about how the pandemic was going to intersect with international security trends. And it was basically saying something along those lines. It's like, I'm very worried about the world that we're entering into, in part because most people in charge of governments, they're not used to dealing with like actual emergencies or crises or national security problems that are like substantive. So the good times are ending, is what I'm afraid of.
So the second question this week is from one of your students. Do you think students around the world are getting screwed by all their courses going online this term?
Good question. What do you guys think?
Yes.
No, hell no. What being screwed, we don't come at all and we're not going to teach you.
Well, I guess because I was in a hall, we all got kicked out by the university.
Over the dorms.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, we all got kicked out, so.
Did they reimburse you for that, Kiara? I don't know. I flat. I'm one of those guys.
No, so not for the first installment that we paid. I'm not sure what's happening with the other ones at all. Wow. But we had 48 hours to get out of the hall.
Yeah, Victoria University shut down the dorms. I'm guessing, have you heard about other universities shutting down dorms?
No, other universities haven't done that.
Hmm. Yeah, Otago's still up and running from what I know.
And I believe Auckland's still running their ones.
Okay, so students are getting screwed any number of ways, I guess. I think the question is getting at, like, are students getting screwed in terms of the educational part of this whole university experience? I think the answer is probably yes. There's a huge, like, a lot of degrees, especially ones that are not, like, engineering or, you know, physics or something. When you're the degree, like, a lot of the value of it comes from the networks you get, like the who you know, the doors that it helps open, the brand of the university itself, like on your degree, like all those things are these huge sources of capital for your life after your degree. And those are like major advantages of it. If you're all online, you lose out on a lot of that stuff. And I doubt that like the online curriculum for Harvard is that dramatically different from like Victoria University. And so the like symbolic value of the brand, if it's all online, it kind of levels out a little bit across universities. I guess I would say that like students are losing out on some of the benefits of the education. And then whether you're losing out on the content, like the shit that you're physically actually learning, really depends on how good you're, you know, faculty are at adapting to teach online. Cause like I've been fucking doing this myself just these last month. It is a totally different experience trying to teach this stuff online. And if you have somebody who's like savvy at doing it, I think it can work. But most of us, to be honest, are not savvy at doing this, especially because we had to like do it on the fly. So I was told that like to set up one good course for an undergraduate course online, it takes a year of prep to structure it in the right way.
Shit.
And we had one fucking week to do it. So like that is not enough time, to say the least. And it shows, like, and now the university is, and this I've seen this replicated across schools. Some universities are just literally shutting down, but universities are acknowledging that like, okay, content delivery for these courses this term is not going to be perfect, which is like an understatement. And so for this term, at least, I think students are getting screwed quite a bit. It would actually be like a very good strategic move, or at least like a good humane move, to just let students finish these courses this term, but then, you know, not charge them the tuition for this term.
That, yeah, like, refund us all.
Yeah.
For paying it.
That would be huge, I think.
See, I'm not one to take a contrarian position, but everyone's sort of getting screwed, if we want to use that sort of terminology.
Yeah.
Like, I think we've just got to suck it up. And I think we're lucky that it's going online, that the university, like as you said, Van, it's going to take a year of solid prep to do it properly. The fact that you guys are even attempting to try and still deliver content to us, I think it's pretty admirable, because you wouldn't have been given a frown internationally to say we're going to shut down, because everywhere else, other places have done it, you know. So I don't think we're being screwed as such. I think everyone's being screwed.
Yeah, so students are not uniquely screwed, I guess.
Yeah, though I guess those who have disability services would still be at a disadvantage due to moving online.
Yeah, there's always disadvantages, though, with learning. Like, I mean, some people have trouble with lectures. Some people get paralyzed by having to interact with other students. So, like, it's like every learning mode has like advantages and disadvantages depending on your personality type. Yeah, interesting question. Also troubling.
Then the third question this week is from a Washingtonian. Did you see the beef between Jeffrey Lewis and Joel Witt of North Korea? What is that about, and why are Korea watchers so petty?
Yeah, man. What are Korea watchers so petty?
Wow.
Does it dig at you?
Yeah, probably. They all are. So as we're recording this, this beef just happened, or the latest fires in it just happened. It's kind of an ongoing thing. If you don't follow Korea stuff, Jeffrey Lewis, the arms control wonk, the first meta pundit on foreign policy, frankly, like, he developed this, you know, public intellectual persona before any of us did, as the technocrat explaining the world to people. And he knows a ton of shit about nukes, and he knows a ton of shit about North Korean strategic capabilities, including nukes and missiles, especially nukes and missiles. Joel Witt, he worked in the State Department in like the 90s and the 80s. He's an arms control guy. He's not a scientist. He's not a scholar. And he bopped around. He wrote this. He co-authored this big book called Going Critical about the first North Korean nuclear crisis. And it's a very widely cited, very famous book. Anybody who wants to talk about like North Korean nukes usually cites this book at some point. And he runs this thing that he created called 38 North, which is like a North Korea watcher, like website, news and analysis site. And it's housed at the Stimson Center now, which is a think tank in D.C. So the Korea Watcher community, because they all focus on the same shit, it's inherently like a little bit petty, or like very, you're always like measuring. It's always, everything is like a dick measuring contest and territorial, you know. So Jeffrey, his claim to fame is he produces all of this like open source analysis, and it's incredible. He's on CNN all the time. CNN is putting up imagery from his shit all the time. And he's just like a globally recognized expert at open source analysis. And he's focused most of that expertise on North Korea shit. And so he's like a darling of media and very popular, and rightly so. And Joel is, his 38 North site does a lot of this same stuff. So like they buy open source imagery as well. And then do analysis on it. The critique of Joel, I have to be careful here because I know both of these guys. So I'm not going to.
Yeah.
It is, what I'll say is that it is not talking shit to point out that Joel is like hated by so many people, like seemingly all of Washington. And he seems to relish that fact. So what happened is like just days ago, maybe 2 days ago, there was some construction going on outside of a missile facility that Jeffrey Lewis was arguing that his shop captured the imagery first and published the analysis first. And they were arguing like, look, this is evidence that North Korea, this specific missile site, is expanding, which is concerning. It has implications that like North Korea is continuing to build out its capabilities. Joel famously is always downplaying the North Korea threat. He takes the position that is favorable to diplomatic engagement. Sometimes that makes sense, sometimes it doesn't really make sense, but it's like a pretty predictable posture that he takes in his analysis. Like, he doesn't want to inflate the threat from North Korea, neither does Jeffrey, but Jeffrey, he calls it like he sees it, right? So Joel's, shortly after Jeffrey's shit got published, Joel's 38 North published basically the same shit, but with different analysis, with a different conclusion, saying like, we think there's nothing to see here. They're not expanding this missile site, and this is just normal construction work. And there's a pretty, like, if you're asking me like who's correct, I mean, Jeffrey's pretty obviously correct, but you can never know for sure, which is why it's easy to always take a crunchyarian position, because you just can never really know.
Yeah, of course.
But because Joel Witt's stuff didn't cite Jeffrey Lewis's, and Jeffrey Lewis's was first, and we're all watching the same shit, so everybody knows. There's no chance that 38 North didn't know about Jeffrey Lewis's stuff. 0% chance they didn't know. And so the proper thing to do is like attribution, right? Even if you disagree with it, yeah, maybe you're wrong or people will disagree with you, but you can have a different take, but you need to acknowledge that like these guys were first and here's what they say. And he didn't do that. So there was this huge Twitter blow up where Jeffrey, who always speaks his mind, truth to power, basically called him like a fuckwad and threw all kinds of shade at him. And in context, it all seems basically appropriate, but it all plays out very negatively on Twitter, obviously. And Joel fired back because he's kind of a curmudgeon and he's like happy to exchange blows with other people. And so it's just been this huge food fight, you know. In some way, I'm like sitting there eating popcorn, watching it.
Like
free entertainment. But in a sense, there's like nothing to see here. And the accusation of a few people is like Joel's team does this sometimes. But I don't know. You know, I'm a Korea watcher, but I don't like jump in on this shit. And I don't want to get involved in it. I've given you the blow by blow here, but, you know, I wash my hands of this nonsense.
Academic mudslinging.
Yeah.
So it sounds like.
Pretty much. Yeah. All right, gang, that's going to do it. WPR.pub/undiplomatic. Sign up for the World Politics Review newsletter. BuyMeACoffee.com/undiplomatic to send us, you know, COVID era money. And catch you next time.
Peace. <Okay. laughs>